Mr. Speaker, thank you. Mr. Speaker, I've been surprised by some of the reaction I've had to my decision to retire. All sorts of motivations have been ascribed to my decision. One of my Cabinet colleagues, who's always concerned about how these sort of things will look for the government, was keen to spread the rumour the real reason could be traced to the existence of a series of incriminating photographs. I was alarmed at the speed at which Murray McCulley was able to invent such a scenario. Well, maybe not. Mr. Speaker, some think it is unnatural that a politician might choose to leave politics well before they absolutely had to. As recently as last month, a constituent wrote to me angrily demanding my resignation. He's going to get pretty excited when he catches up with the news. Although I prefer to focus on the past 3 years, there's no escaping the fact that I have been here for 12. I was elected to Parliament in late 1999 as a 28-year-old, following a very narrow victory in the great seat of Rangitiki by 289 votes. When I first came to this House, I was encouraged to be partisan, an aggressive debater, a contributor to the partisan approach, and told the most important thing in opposition was to hold the government to account. Thanks, Roger Sarri. That was a view that I passed on to others who came after me, and it remains on one level fundamentally correct. I am not one of those who yearns for a question time devoid of robust exchanges, where members might acknowledge points made by their opposite number with a genteel, "Well played, sir." Question time is, for those who know how to use it, still the best opportunity to fulfil one of Parliament's primary functions, scrutiny of the executive. But my perspective on politics changed dramatically in my third term in opposition, when I nearly went round the bend with the grinding negativity and lack of progress that can become so entrenched on the opposition benches. So, Mr. Speaker, I began to plan for government, not knowing whether we would win or not, as a means of doing something constructive. With a few close colleagues, I started to piece together what a justice and commerce agenda might just look like. Politicians, Mr. Speaker, must have a plan that is in place early and one that they are prepared to lead. And I believe that politics is 90% preparation and 10% execution. At a day-to-day level, politics, particularly at a ministerial level, can quickly deteriorate to the daily management of tasks, dealing with papers, the media, OIA requests, question time, written questions, expectations from colleagues and your party. Tasks that can become all-consuming and tasks that in the end do not improve the lives of New Zealanders at all. That's not why we run for Parliament. We run to lead agendas, to improve the lot of our countrymen, to push change and to execute on ideas. People don't spend years getting elected, more years wanting to get into Cabinet, to then say, "Well, I managed that week well, I minimised risk, had no view, took no decision, stayed out of trouble, well done me." Once in office, you've got to do something. And that's why having a plan matters. And ideas also matter. In politics, ideas matter more than the political players themselves, because all of us will come and go. But the ideas will endure. Mr. Speaker, politicians should manage less and lead more. I love the quote from the influential Republican media advisor Roger Ailes, who has moved to quip, "When I die, I want to come back with real power. I want to come back as a member of a focus group." Actually, Mr. Speaker, taking a position and selling it, persuading and debating, that is what politics is all about. Yeah, it sounds idealistic, and maybe it is, but I always told myself I would leave politics before the idealism left me, Mr. Speaker. That doesn't mean that we should not be open to compromise, where it improves the eventual decision in a more democratic way. A formative experience in my last year in opposition triggered a fundamental shift in the way that I viewed politics. As chair of the Privileges Committee in the last term of Parliament, I had to chair the inquiry into the matter of certain donations to the New Zealand First Party. My view of politics and how best to participate in it was altered from that point on. This was a highly partisan issue in front of a parliamentary committee which had a history of being above politics. I realised then that working with other political parties to reach consensus, where possible, was a legitimate way to advance legislation and to progress an agenda. Now, not everyone agrees with me on this approach, but I know I'm right. My experience has been that expanding the decision-making mandate without sacrificing the kernel of the idea has improved the quality of the legislative product immeasurably. Mr. Speaker, that means not being afraid to back down, not being afraid to reconsider a position after listening to an alternative view, and at least in one case, not being afraid to amend a bill on the floor of the House in response to high-quality debate. Now, it may not have been understood by all, and you have to grit your teeth a bit through the inevitable government back-down headlines, but with the support of the Prime Minister and the freedom he gave me to operate in that manner on many, many bills, it worked. So much of Parliament's time is spent attacking each other, trying to outmanoeuvre each other, and just plain loathing each other. And it can be an incredible waste of energy and time. And whenever I was sitting in frustrating cross-party discussions, or in the House during a particularly rough debate, I was always reminded of Michael Corleone's edict. Never hate your enemies. It just clouds your judgment. Good and meaningful policy is also informed and shaped by personal interactions. Mr. Speaker, to the day I die, I will never forget sitting in the lounge of Gill and Leslie Elliott in Dunedin, listening to them describe to me their experiences of the justice system. It had a profound effect on me in the way that I viewed our legal system. Good, decent, kind people whose lives were destroyed by tragedy deserve our help, not a slow-motion replay of the horror that they went through. My interactions with the communities that deal with victims of sexual violence have similarly affected my view on how our justice system should operate. Likewise, Mr. Speaker, the way our court system deals with children is unacceptable. Long delays, barbaric practices, all in the name of tradition and precedent, all abject nonsense. Mr. Speaker, there is still so much for others to do, and many problems remain deeply embedded in our country's culture. What the hell is it about the psyche of this country that we feel the need to go home and hit someone, be it a partner, a child, or another family member? This is totally unjustifiable. It's wrong, and it's an indictment on us as a society. Our legal system needs to protect these people. And I hope I've made a small contribution to remedying these despicable acts of injustice and cowardice. The decisions we face are often difficult, Mr. Speaker, but that's why we're here. And I was surprised to learn when I became Minister of Justice that many of my predecessors had delegated the Royal Prerogative of Mercy applications to an associate minister. I have found this to be some of the most interesting and challenging work I have done as a minister. However, I remain troubled by a number of these cases. Though I do not criticise those involved in the process at all, I think there is merit in reinforcing the independence of the advice from the Ministry of Justice and moving decision-making to a separate, independent body. Although the Peter Ellis matter was straightforward in the end, because appeal rights had not yet been exhausted, a basic requirement of the exercise of the prerogative of mercy, the wider case worried me and continues to worry me. It's our job to tackle the tough issues, the issues the public pays us to front up to and come to a view on. There are many, many debates that Parliament does not want to have for fear of losing votes or not staying on message. Abortion, adoption law, children's rights and sexual violence issues. I do not share this timid view. The truth is, if we don't have those debates here, where will we have them, Mr. Speaker? Surely people don't run for Parliament claiming they want to make a difference, only to vote for the status quo. Otherwise, presumably, they'd be so satisfied with the way the country was running, they wouldn't feel the need to seek public office in the first place. Phrases such as, "it wasn't like that in my day," "precedent and tradition matter," or my personal favourite, "it never did me any harm," to justify no change simply don't reflect the new reality of a fast-moving, modern country. I have a great deal of confidence in the New Zealand public's high level of intelligence and engagement in discussing those issues at some point, whenever that may be. But I also have great confidence, Mr. Speaker, that Parliament is capable of rising to the challenge and dealing with those issues with dignity and distinction. Mr. Speaker, I've been privileged to serve with some wonderful people. Some have said I'm going too early, some have not. But I've loved every minute of it, and that's exactly the right time to go. A few specific thanks are in order. The Prime Minister, whose confidence I have enjoyed and who has given me plenty of rope, some of which I've used. And of the 462 papers I took to Cabinet, on only one did you phone and say, "I can't support this one, Simon." And I'm extremely grateful for those that you did, Prime Minister. Thanks for everything, John. You have been great to work with. To my friend Bill English, loyalty in politics is sadly a rare commodity, but it matters in this game. Thanks. Your depth and breadth on policy matters and personal grit I greatly admire, even for a doer South Island social conservative. For my benchmate Jerry, the best instincts in the game, often ahead of the pack, and a wonderful self-deprecating humour. I've really enjoyed your company on the benches, Jerry. Nothing sums Jerry up more acutely than the time we went to get fish and chips for the caucus during urgency in the early hours of the morning in the year 2000. Must have been about 4 o'clock in the morning. He stormed into the fish and chip shop at 4 a.m. as this tiny little man behind the counter. And Jerry stormed up and said, "I want 42 pieces of fish, 40 scoops of chips, and 31 hot dogs." Then he looked at me and he said, "And what do you want?" After to the class of 1999, Tolly, Tish, Heatley and Hutch, we still have a drink every Tuesday the House sits, and you've provided me with a wealth of grounded opinions and reflections. To my friend Chester Burrows, for your gentle common sense, and to my old political friend, Catherine Rich, who was a great source of advice and wisdom. The dark years, as we called them, were better for a whiskey and a chat about the day's events. Catherine, you would have been a stunning minister. To my team in the Rangitiki, Bruce, Norma, Suze, Jackie, Sonia, Christine, Viv, Stuart, John O, Merv, Marion, Helen, Dye, thank you for everything. Thank you for getting me here. To the people of Rangitiki, I'll always be grateful for your confidence in me. GJ, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for your help in 1999. Thanks very much. And of course, the mole. A plan conceived in a pub in Auckland in 1997 was executed. Thanks, Mole. To Professor Margaret Clark for first turning my mind to a political career and for keeping me on my toes since then. To Peter Bamber, who spent 5 years with me in opposition, grim times, I don't know how you coped, Thanks to my seconded departmental private secretaries who bought into the cause, and to Sarah for keeping my whereabouts orderly. To my ministerial staff, the best in the beehive, the pit, Stephen, Kate, Brent and Rachel, simply the cleverest, hardest working, fairest people I know in politics. Utterly objective, scrupulously honest. You're all stars. To Gemma, my SPS, who's been with me for 7 years and is referred to in my office as the left side, as in the left side of his brain. Gemma, you've run my life for so long, you'll be ready for something new outside of Parliament. I've never met anyone or worked with anyone as professionally competent as you are. Thank you for everything, and you can feel free to roll your eyes behind my back. And finally, to my friends and family, friends put up with so much when you're in politics. And as my close friend James said to me when I told him I was retiring, thank God you've become such a pain in the ass. Well, I'm keen to make up for it, and brothers, I thank you for your patience. To my family, for your unstinting support, Mum and Dad, when I decided to get in, then out of politics. And to Lisa, Sam and Harry, I think some of the best advice I got as a minister was on the sports field sidelines on Saturday morning, watching the boys sport, and that's where I intend to spend more time. And each day, while I was shaving, I would look in the mirror and ask myself the same question. Will those two boys be proud of what I do today? And I hope you will be. Lisa, thank you for everything. Private life awaits. It'll be fun. I guarantee it. So, Mr. Speaker, I bid you farewell and leave you with one thought. We all know that it's a privilege being a member of Parliament, but the most satisfaction should come from doing rather than being.